Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
This podcast is a production of Nuanced Tales in partnership with WFAE, distributed by the NPR Network.
Anger and bewilderment are growing as more and more Americans cope with gasoline lines and empty pumps.
In the late 1970s, a series of crises cascaded. They looked eerily familiar. Gas shortages.
I'm in a line 2 hours in. I can't get gas. This is baloney. Carter doesn't get my vote next year.
There was inflation.
Prices have skyrocketed on nearly everything.
And recession.
Long lines at area unemployment offices.
The recession seems to be worsening steadily.
We are headed for deep trouble.
A nation that prided itself on military strength was humbled.
The U.S. Embassy in Tehran has been invaded and occupied by Iranian students.
Demonstrators refuse to make any promises about the fate of the American hostages.
The threats to security, prosperity, and national pride, it felt catastrophic.
We do not know how the story will end. And anxiety grows naturally with every passing hour.
It was a climate of uncertainty as 1980 approached. Disillusionment and distrust. America in decline. The same problems Gerald Ford had encountered 4 years earlier. Problems that President Jimmy Carter had promised to solve. And where was the president?
The White House press office didn't know where he was.
He'd hold himself away.
The president is in seclusion at Camp David.
Some worried he'd crumbled under the pressure.
The White House said the president is not suffering from nervous exhaustion.
Instead, Carter was searching for a way to reach Americans, to warn them. He saw the national mood as an existential problem. He emerged from seclusion to make an unusual, heartfelt plea.
I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy.
He called the threat a crisis of confidence. He said that the American people needed to believe in their systems and institutions, or they would lose them.
We simply must have faith in each other, faith in our ability to govern ourselves, and faith in the future of this nation.
But voters had chosen Carter to fix problems, not lecture about them. He had promised to change the country and, quote, make it great again. The fact he was giving this speech just showed he'd failed. So more and more voters considered replacing Carter, even if it meant with a candidate who'd been unthinkable just a few years earlier. A candidate with what were seen as radical beliefs about government's role in America. I'm Ben Bradford, and this is Landslide. Over the past 6 episodes of this season, you've heard a pressure building under the surface of 1970s American politics. After Watergate and Vietnam, new distrust.
Most people think either that the federal government has made no change in their lives or made their lives worse.
There was a growing, increasingly organized backlash against social change.
Emotions carry the day.
The new right conservatism.
And you heard these forces grab control of the Republican Party.
I believe the Republican Party has a platform that is a banner of bold, unmistakable colors with no pale pastel shades.
The GOP was now a conservative party, socially and culturally, as well as economically. Something new in modern American politics. But it was not a mainstream party. It hadn't proven it could win. And the party was not yet complete. One last block of voters who would come to define the new Republican Party had not yet been assimilated. For all of that, we have to turn to the 1980 election, when the pressure building underneath American politics erupted. On this season finale of Landslide, Jimmy Carter is the embattled president, facing Ronald Reagan in a campaign that ended an era, but one where it seemed like either could win up until the very end. It's important to understand what had gone wrong for Carter, and just how badly. He had entered office with such promise, buoyed by an approving public.
The American people very much liked Jimmy Carter's first month as president.
They liked him, the outsider, the engineer. Saturday Night Live, which had skewered Jerry Ford as a klutz, portrayed Carter as so hyper-competent he could handle any situation, including talking a caller down from a bad acid trip.
Peter, what did the acid look like?
They were these little orange pills.
Were they barrel-shaped?
Yes.
Okay, right, you did some orange sunshine, Peter.
He couldn't live up to the image. Who could? And that only worked against him when he failed to solve the problems of the time. Inflation and recession grew worse.
Those rating him as doing a good job dropped 10 points.
He'd promised to level with the American people, but they didn't seem to like that either.
We must face a time of national austerity. Hard choices are necessary.
And the president's popularity is still going down.
He had promised to clean up government, so reporters latched onto any hint of staff scandal, even ones that would have gotten short shrift in years prior.
Mr. Carter's approval rating has dropped below 50% for the first time.
Every achievement, and there were achievements, always seemed to be overwhelmed by a new crisis. Landon Butler, the president's deputy chief of staff, says the bad news would not stop.
We were being battered right and left. It just seemed like we couldn't get anywhere.
Only 27% of the people we talked to think Mr. Carter is doing a good job of running the country. 1% higher than Richard Nixon's rating just before he resigned.
We couldn't get out of our own way.
Linda Peake Schacht worked in the White House press office, and she says Carter's historic unpopularity wasn't just a result of bad luck or global conditions.
An inexperienced White House staff, and I include myself in that, came to Washington not understanding the importance of developing the relationships we needed.
The outsider president arrived with an outsider staff. They planned to sweep in and overhaul the federal government. But that's not how our system works. Democrats, Carter's own party, had ruled Congress for decades. Imagine their reaction when their new president, just days in office, told the press he was canceling lucrative water projects in their House districts.
This is a very poor way for the White House to build good relations here on Capitol Hill.
We were seen as aliens, as people who were unwilling to compromise, and importantly, unwilling to acknowledge other power centers.
The penny-pinching conservative Carter found himself pitted against a Democratic Congress long centered on labor unions, spending programs, and the New Deal. He refused to horse trade. Anger swelled in other important Democratic constituencies. Influential voices denounced him. Civil rights attorney Joseph Rao.
The real problem in this Congress was the absence, the total absence of any presidential leadership.
Women's rights leader Gloria Steinem.
He is finally going to have to do something for us to get us to vote for him.
And prominent black congressman Ron Dellums.
We gave him an opportunity to lead, and if he's not willing to lead and doesn't have the courage or the sensitivity to lead, then we reject Jimmy Carter.
All of the goodwill Carter entered office with bled away amid crisis, scandal, and personal disputes. The country was disillusioned. His party was fractured. And in late 1979, a year before the election, one Democratic senator planned a mutiny.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC Health/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.
Within the red brick of Boston's Faneuil Hall, a historic site where American revolutionaries once met, another rebellion took shape. The nation's most famous senator, Ted Kennedy, stood on the podium. With marble busts of past presidents behind him, Kennedy publicly condemned the current president of his own party.
For many months, we have been sinking into crisis. Yet we hear no clear summons from the center of power.
Kennedy was fed up with Carter. The Georgia bumpkin had thundered in holier than thou with no respect for the traditions of the party. He turned it to the right and made a mess. Now the brother of John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy was here to put an end to it. He announced he would run for president against Carter, just as Ronald Reagan had against Gerald Ford 4 years earlier.
This country is not prepared to sound retreat. It is ready to advance. It is willing to make a stand, and so am I.
The cheers rained down. Who could better foil the flailing Carter in the crisis of confidence than the urbane, charismatic senator? His brother's administration had been known as Camelot. And the polls showed something extraordinary.
An overwhelming 33-point lead.
Kennedy looked like he would walk over the sitting president for the nomination. Carter's top aides, including Tom Donilon, prepared for a brutal fight from a political powerhouse.
He was the prohibitive favorite. It was going to be the return of Camelot.
Democrats had the rare opportunity to swap out their unpopular president. They would shift away from the conservative outsider and restore the party to what it had been. Except, none of that materialized. Kennedy's window closed almost as soon as he'd opened it. CBS ran an hour-long special about the senator. It included interviews with him, where the reporter posed deeply personal questions.
What's the present state of your marriage, Senator?
Well, I think that it's a...
Kennedy struggled to answer, including the most important question.
Why do you want to be president?
Well, I'm...
On another channel, the movie Jaws was making its television debut. Republican Senator Bob Dole quipped he couldn't tell the difference. The CBS report punctured Kennedy's mystique. Here was just another flawed candidate, not Camelot. And he lost any chance to recover from it due to another event that same night, thousands of miles away, in Iran.
The U.S. Embassy in Tehran has been invaded and occupied by Iranian students. The Americans inside have been taken prisoner.
Iranian students stormed the U.S. Embassy building. They broke open the lock with bolt cutters, and they captured the Americans inside.
One American, blindfolded, handcuffed. He and 60-some others still held hostage and threatened in a country gone out of control.
The hostage-taking seemed to Kennedy like a prime example of Carter's failures. Lack of foresight and poor decision-making leading to a major foreign policy crisis. But that's not how the public saw it.
He got a rally round the flag lift.
Linda Peek Schacht was now Carter's campaign press secretary.
Initially, it was a major foreign policy crisis, but it caused Americans to rally around him.
Carter rebounded because of the hostage crisis.
There's been a spectacular change.
His public approval rating jumped from 30% to 61%.
It's one of the biggest turnarounds in the history of the polls.
Carter seized his new popularity. The president announced he would not campaign against Kennedy because his sole focus would be the freeing of the hostages. It was the Rose Garden strategy Gerald Ford had used against him.
It insulated him from attack.
his advisor, Stu Eisenstadt.
It's only when it dragged out longer and longer and longer and longer that the political advantage began to diminish.
In the meantime, Kennedy found himself alone on the campaign trail, almost an afterthought, railing against an opponent he'd expected to cruise past.
Mr. Carter will not come out of that White House or the Rose Garden, but we're going to get him out of that White House and the Rose Garden.
He didn't. And when the voting started, Carter beat Kennedy thoroughly in Iowa, New Hampshire, Vermont, Alabama, 11 out of the first dozen contests, which meant the Democrats' one viable alternative to their president was no longer really an option, just as Carter's approval plummeted back through the floor. Public goodwill drained away as the hostage crisis dragged on.
The Iran crisis enters its third month.
It continued to dominate the news.
Day 142 of the Iran hostage crisis.
Good evening. This 152nd day of the hostage crisis.
The Iran crisis. America held hostage.
The steady drumbeat of coverage never wavered, never faded into the background, as most ongoing stories eventually do. Which is odd when you think about it. Carter advisor Stu Eisenstadt says it was Carter's own doing when he decided to lock himself away and make the hostages his sole focus.
It forced attention on it because the president forced attention. Instead of going about his business and saying, this is a problem, I'm going to deal with it, but it's one of many problems, it made him a hostage in the White House.
But also, the hostage crisis epitomized the feeling of this moment in America.
It was the sense of a loss of control.
The crisis of confidence. By the time Carter entered the Democratic National Convention, he had won renomination, but lost the American people, including in his own party.
The convention was a disaster.
Cheers in the convention hall rang louder for Ted Kennedy. Kennedy had stayed in the race till the bitter end, seemingly out of spite. Delegates and party stalwarts announced they would not support Carter in the general election, even though his opponent was Ronald Reagan.
At this point, no.
Defectors included the National Organization for Women and the Farm Workers Union, said its vice president, Dolores Huerta.
I don't see how we or the people that we represent can work for him.
By the final night of the convention, even the venue had turned against Carter. He waved, sweating under hot lights, having just finished his acceptance speech. The band played, and the celebratory balloons that were supposed to avalanche down for the victor refused to fall.
Those thousands of red, white, and blue balloons are still stuck up there near the ceiling of Madison Square Garden.
They hung clumped together in shipping container-sized garbage bags. Event staff tugged fruitlessly on ropes to unleash them, but only a few mournfully trickled out. Could you find a more apt metaphor for the 1980 Democratic nominee? For Jimmy Carter, even the balloons wouldn't fall. Meanwhile, printers buzzed. As Jimmy Carter foundered, the New Right, that tangle of conservative organizations, found fertile ground for cultivating more social discontent. An anti-tax revolt in California.
The taxpayers have spoken.
Continued backlash to a Panama Canal treaty.
The American Conservative Union began a blitz of television commercials today.
Printers buzzed for these causes, linking them into the other grievances of the New Right. More letters poured out, savaging Jimmy Carter. New Right groups helped singer Anita Bryant go on the attack against gay and lesbian rights.
She's going nationwide with her anti-gay rights campaign.
And all the while, money and names for the New Right's mailing lists poured in. By the 1980 election, New Right groups would gather a political war chest larger than any other single outside interests. That includes corporations, labor unions, even the political parties themselves. And yet, Paul Weyrich was not satisfied. Weyrich was the top organizer of the New Right, the founder of a host of conservative groups.
When I came here, the conservative movement was so small that...
This is Weyrich giving a speech a few years after the events of this story.
There was no network, there was no institutions, and I mean, it was a pretty sorry state of affairs. And we began to build little institutions here and there and have some impact.
Weyrich had personally led the building of little institutions called the Heritage Foundation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the House Republican Study Committee. But he was frustrated because there was a whole swath of Americans who he knew could supercharge his movement, if only they weren't staunchly opposed to political activity. The group Weyrich wanted to attract was evangelical Christians, people who identified as born again.
The old-time religion is that all men are sinners by nature, born in sin, conceived in iniquity.
Each week, televangelists like Jerry Falwell preached fire and brimstone to millions of devoted followers.
We present the old-time gospel hour with the pastor, Dr. Jerry Falwell.
Falwell and others like him raised money from their flocks through huge mailing lists, just like the New Right. Imagine combining them. Except evangelicals, for decades, had dismissed politics as a worldly concern. Many weren't even registered to vote. Their views were diverse. Weyrich had tried to change that.
He said, I'd been trying since the Goldwater campaign in 1964 to get these people, meaning evangelicals, mobilized politically.
Religious historian Randall Balmer, an evangelical Christian himself, remembers interviewing Weyrich about this.
He said, I tried everything. I tried the abortion issue. I tried the school prayer issue. I tried pornography issue. I tried the women's rights issue. Nothing got their attention.
But then, Jimmy Carter did. First, in 1976. It was exciting. A faith-on-his-sleeve, born-again Christian might be president, one of their own.
We had a sense of ourselves as evangelicals as being very much a kind of neglected minority. And so when a candidate running for president is beginning to be taken seriously, that caught our attention.
On that late and narrow 1976 election night,
thank you very much.
Analysts believed evangelical voters might have made the difference.
If you didn't have this turnaround of Carter getting a huge majority with white Baptists tonight, he'd have been in deep trouble.
Evangelicals helped install Jimmy Carter. It showed the political power they could wield. And then, they felt, he betrayed them. The televangelist Jerry Falwell, for example. Falwell had his church, and he had his television program. And he had schools, both elementary and college. Jerry Falwell also had been, in the not-too-distant past, an avowed segregationist. And these things were connected. He had founded his elementary school specifically as a haven for white students to avoid integrated public schools. The Lynchburg Christian Academy was what was known as a segregation academy. It was one of thousands created in the years after the Civil Rights Act. Jimmy Carter's IRS announced it was cracking down.
The Internal Revenue Service has begun hearings in Washington on its proposal to take away the tax-exempt status of hundreds of private schools.
Outrage rippled through religious communities at the government intrusion. Parents and school administrators flooded the IRS's hearings.
Most of the witnesses were angry.
We have had it.
Some were angry because they'd been caught in the dragnet, even though they weren't running segregation academies. But a whole lot showed up because they were.
These men do not have the rightful authority to tell us how to run our schools, our homes, and our churches.
Years later, Paul Weyrich, the New Right organizer, pointed to this as the watershed moment in his effort to mobilize evangelicals, says Randall Balmer.
When the Internal Revenue Service began coming after the tax exemption of evangelical schools, meaning segregation academies, he said that's what got the movement started.
Weyrich secured a meeting with Jerry Falwell. He laid out how a new organization could link into the network of the New Right, combining their mailing lists, their activism, their outrage. Falwell liked it. And a few months later, he incorporated his new group as the Moral Majority. You could hear a simultaneous shift in his sermons, increasingly political.
Homosexuality is sin. And so sometimes we get a little bit tired when we see our leaders in Washington ignoring what the Bible has to say.
He preached for his followers to get involved against legislation to help defeat the Equal Rights Amendment.
Now, I'm accused sometimes of being political when I come out against ERA. ERA is not a political issue. It is a moral issue.
Falwell wasn't alone in his new activism. Weyrich met with other evangelical leaders who formed more groups, Christian Voice and the Religious Roundtable. Around the country, he exhorted gatherings of evangelicals to join the cause.
We need to work together at the grassroots level and take control.
This is Weyrich a decade later, but his rhetoric is similar to what he was delivering to evangelical groups at this time.
It's just like in battle, just like a war. And after all, this is a war, isn't it?
He advocated scorched earth politics, no compromise.
That's why we have to go out there and polarize the electorate.
And he pushed for a relentless focus on cultural and social wedge issues to bring them to the front line of the battle between the political parties.
If we put the social agenda in order, in other words, if we put God first, the economic issues will follow by themselves.
Within just a span of months during the Carter administration, a new political force took shape, the Christian right. Focused on social issues with a hardline strategy of no compromise. This would be the final element in the new conservative GOP.
Those are the seeds of the culture war that we see today.
Ronald Reagan saw an opportunity.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then, just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Jimmy Carter had to battle for his party's nomination. Meanwhile, Ronald Reagan steamrolled.
Governor Reagan, one of the big winners tonight.
He's just won five straight presidential primaries.
One of his campaign managers once said that after 1976, all Reagan had to do to claim the Republican nomination was stay alive.
Barring something disastrous to his campaign, he will be the nominee of the Republican Party.
He won primaries and caucuses in 44 states. He easily became his party's presidential candidate. No one else came close. And as he campaigned, Reagan made some unusual stops. He visited Bob Jones University in South Carolina.
A fundamentalist school known as the Buckle of the Bible Belt.
Bob Jones University was well known for a particularly racist school policy, a ban on interracial dating. And because of it, Jimmy Carter's IRS was seeking to strip the school of its tax-exempt status. Here's what Reagan told the students.
I think it is time for us to tell the president we don't care whether they like us or not. We're determined to be respected.
Reagan was aligning with the brand new Christian right. He endeared himself as their candidate. You could see the nexus established between Reagan, the Christian right, and the new right later in the year at a hockey arena in Dallas. Thousands of pastors crowded in for a first-of-its-kind two-day conference that mixed God, politics, and organized discontent.
We must begin to literally penetrate every area of our society.
The televangelist James Robison had organized it as an ostensibly nonpartisan gathering. We called for reduced spending, locking up the unbridled, excessive, uncontrolled federal government. Other speakers included Jerry Falwell, the firebrand conservative senator Jesse Helms, and New Right luminaries Phil Schlafly and Paul Weyrich. And one presidential candidate sat on the stage on the final night, listening and smiling amiably at what he heard. And when it was Ronald Reagan's turn to speak, the crowd went wild. And they went wild again at his first statement.
I know that you can't endorse me, but I only brought that up because I want you to know that I endorse you and what you are doing.
But of course, those cheers showed they did endorse Reagan and the new conservative Republican Party. It was Reagan's party, the Christian Rights Party, a party that fused their shared hostility towards government, the belief that it was on the brink of totalitarianism, along with a focus on social issues and culture war, backlash against civil rights, all topped with a new moral fervor. This combination was obvious at the Republican National Convention that year. The nominee, Reagan, huddled privately with the big names of the new right and the Christian right, Jerry Falwell, Phil Schlafly, Paul Weyrich. And when delegates passed the Republican Party platform, it not only condemned abortion and the ERA, but also the IRS for its, quote, regulatory vendetta against private schools.
Moral majority also influenced the Republican platform. Falwell now calls it a dream platform.
A few remaining liberal Republicans still hanging on were aghast.
So it's a takeover, so to speak. You not only have to be a conservative, you have to be a born-again Christian conservative.
One longtime congressman, John Anderson, announced he was splitting to launch an independent bid. That was fine. The liberal Republican would just take more votes from Carter. And these were exceptions. Most of the old GOP establishment enthusiastically got on board. Their party had been declared near extinction just a few years before. Now they had the opportunity to topple the Democrats.
This is a new party. We don't like being in second place, and we don't intend to stay there.
As the general election approached, polls showed Reagan swamping Jimmy Carter, who was so unpopular. But there was one lingering question, the same question that always dogged the one-time actor. When it came down to it, would voters really pull the lever for someone as extreme as Ronald Reagan? Reagan had run deeply to the country's right. It had won him conservatives and the new right and the Christian right, and ultimately his party's nomination. But that was a minority of the total electorate. Democrats at this time still outnumbered Republicans more than 2-1, and for a lot of people, this new GOP with Reagan at its head was scary.
I don't think the man is electable as a president. I hope not.
It looks like you're snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
This, from talk show host Phil Donahue and famed Chicago columnist Mike Royko, was the conventional view of Reagan. It was a view shared by Jimmy Carter and his aides.
We thought he was the best person to run against.
Luna Piekschacht and Stu Eisenstadt.
We thought he had played in too many cowboy movies and that he was too scary a candidate to be elected.
Reagan had heard this tune before, in every campaign he'd run, and his polls against Carter looked great, on the surface. But dig a little deeper, and he could see the danger. On his best days, Reagan was drawing somewhere around 45% of voters, with Carter down near 30. It was a double-digit lead, but no one had a majority. If Reagan was too frightening, voters could easily stampede back to the president, a known quantity. So Reagan entered the general election with a clear goal: convince Americans that he was reasonable. Or at least that they had more to fear from sticking with Carter.
That Carter's record is a litany of despair, of broken promises, of sacred trusts abandoned and forgotten.
In his official campaign kickoff speech, he laced into the president. An American flag waved in the wind. The Statue of Liberty rose behind him. From this vantage, Reagan pitched himself as the alternative who would trade in the crisis of confidence for optimism and the American dream.
This country needs a new administration with a renewed dedication to the dream of an America, an administration that will give that dream new life and make America great again.
Reagan offered his usual remedies, lower taxes, less government. But more notable was what the speech lacked. He made no mention of abortion or the ERA or other divisive social issues that had marked his primary campaign. Instead, Reagan made voters a promise that he could solve their economic problems without asking them to sacrifice as Carter was. This was the campaign strategy. Reagan as amiable and reasonable, the hopeful alternative to the pessimistic Carter. It was a winning script, if only the candidate would stop straying from it.
At this time, it's a real pleasure to present to you Governor Reagan, Governor.
Reagan made his first campaign stop in the general election, even before his kickoff speech, to a Mississippi town infamous for a Ku Klux Klan lynching of civil rights workers. There, Reagan proclaimed to his almost all-white audience,
"I believe in states' rights."
If you didn't catch that, he said, "I believe in states' rights," a code phrase that had long been used to defend segregation. The audience loved it. But this was a blunder. Reagan usually kept the racial undertones of his appeal more subtle. 2 weeks later, he blundered again. Reagan extolled the Vietnam War.
"Well, it's time that we recognized ours was in truth a noble cause."
More gaffes followed. He repeated a conspiracy theory that air pollution was mostly natural. He criticized teaching children about evolution.
"But if it was going to be taught in the schools, then I would think that also the biblical theory of creation, which is not a theory, but the biblical story of creation, should also be taught."
The former actor kept ad-libbing away from his optimistic economic message. Each time, it pulled focus from Carter's failures, and it reinforced how outside the mainstream Reagan really was. And the statements were odd from a usually disciplined candidate. It drummed up a new question. Why was he wandering so far off script?
"There was the age thing."
Frank Donatelli worked for Reagan's campaign.
"The guy was 69 years old. I know that's young by today's standards, but he was the oldest candidate of a major party since Eisenhower. And Eisenhower was like 8 years younger than Reagan when he was elected."
In other words, was Reagan losing it? As the questions grew, Carter attacked. His strategy was to divert attention from himself and fan the worries about Reagan.
"Throw fear into the American people that this guy couldn't be trusted."
"I consider this one of the most serious threats to the safety and the security and the peace of our nation and the world you've seen in this campaign, the stirrings of hate and the rebirth of code words like states' rights."
Carter caught flack for being too mean, but the attacks had their effect. Reagan's poll numbers sagged.
"Reagan, according to some politicians, is off to about as bad a start in his campaign as Teddy Kennedy was in his."
The 1980 campaign shifted from a referendum on the president and the problems of his term to his challenger, and whether Reagan was too extreme and too old. Voters increasingly thought he was, and his polls sagged further.
"The latest Gallup poll shows the Reagan-Carter race too close to call."
Reagan had squandered a tremendous lead.
"This campaign may have peaked too early or may be stalled."
If the trend continued, he could lose to a historically unpopular president. What an embarrassment that would be. What a setback for his conservative cause. In fact, it could be the final indictment that such an ideological party simply could not win in American politics. Those were the stakes, with 3 weeks left before Election Day. Reagan huddled with his advisors. What should he do to turn it around?
"We were kind of dead in the water. There were people in the campaign that thought, Carter is so unpopular, the people will eventually come around. But there were others that said, you don't know that. If they're skeptical of us, they may remain skeptical of us." So it was a tough call.
Reagan could stand pat or take a risk to change the race.
Reagan made the decision in the end.
He chose risk. a head-to-head showdown against Carter.
The top of the news at this hour, the stage is set for a one-on-one debate between President Carter and Ronald Reagan.
A debate would be the ultimate roll of the dice. Reagan's advisors had long urged against it. Who knows what he might say? A gaffe live on stage could end him. Carter jumped at the chance.
We've accepted this invitation immediately because it's what we've wanted from the very beginning.
We worked out there would be one debate, and it would be a week before the election. That's the closest to an election a debate has ever been.
That close, there would be no time to recover from any mistake or gaffe.
So this was it.
The 1980 debate. A Super Bowl-sized audience tuned in to watch.
President Jimmy Carter, the Democratic Party's candidate for re-election to the presidency, and Governor Ronald Reagan of California, the Republican Party's candidate for the presidency. The candidates will debate.
The two deadlocked candidates stood at lecterns facing a panel of questioners. On stage, under the hot lights, Carter looked solemn and composed. In image alone, he immediately cut against the popular conception that he was overwhelmed and underwater. When he opened his first answer, his familiar flat voice was more energetic than usual. He reminded his audience of one important area where he had not failed. He had kept them safe.
We've not only kept peace for our own country, but we've been able to extend the benefits of peace to others.
His voice stayed matter-of-fact as he transitioned to an attack. Reagan would not keep the peace.
I think habitually, Governor Reagan has advocated the injection of military forces into troubled areas.
The attack built as the debate went on. Not only might Reagan start a war, it could be nuclear.
He makes a very disturbing comment that non-proliferation or the control of the spread of nuclear weapons is none of our business.
Carter painted a picture of a reactionary, an extremist unfit for office.
You can have points in campaigns where these debates can answer the question, the key question about a candidacy.
Carter aide Tom Donilon says the president was hammering the key question that had always followed Reagan.
The question was, is he too dangerous?
He's extremely dangerous. Dangerous. Very dangerous.
Is he too crazy?
Completely irresponsible.
Can you imagine this man as president of the United States?
Would destroy this nation. Bankrupt it.
Carter painted a devastating picture. Or it might have been, if not for the fact that viewers could see across the stage. They saw, standing there, not an extremist, but the kindly, reasonable, amiable, one-time host of GE Theater. And he was disappointed at the suggestion he wanted war.
I have seen four wars in my lifetime. I'm a father of sons. I have a grandson. I don't ever want to see another generation of young Americans bleed their lives into sandy beachheads in the Pacific or rice paddies and jungles in the...
With pathos, humor, and charisma, Reagan diffused Carter's attacks.
There you go again.
He made them seem hysterical.
I know the president is supposed to be replying to me, but sometimes I have a hard time in connecting what he's saying with what I have said or what my positions are. I sometimes think it's like the witch doctor that gets mad when a good doctor comes along with a cure that'll work.
It was a performance that broke open the race.
Reagan went on that stage that night, and of course, people could kind of look at him, close their eyes, and imagine him as president. He crossed this invisible threshold of acceptability into the presidency.
Having crossed that threshold, Reagan closed the debate with a key question of his own for voters.
Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls, will stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
For most Americans who had lived through inflation, recession, hostages, fuel shortages, there was only one answer.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
For Jimmy Carter on election night, the balloons wouldn't fall.
Ronald Reagan, the former movie actor, former governor of California, at 69 years old, has taken a strong lead tonight toward becoming the 40th president of the United States.
Election night coincided with the anniversary of the hostage crisis. One final reminder before voters pulled the lever of how their president had failed them.
It is going very fast and very badly.
Ronald Reagan is taking the West by storm.
He is winning in all of the key areas, the industrial Midwest, parts of the Northeast, and the South as well.
A race that had seemed up in the air days earlier turned into something else.
It is, at this point, by all odds, a landslide for Ronald Reagan.
It's an absolute landslide just trouncing him.
And yet, exit polls showed something remarkable. Only 1 in 10 Reagan voters claimed they supported him because of his ideology. Most voters said they still wanted the robust government of the past. They were just fed up with Carter. And turnout was desultory. Barely half the electorate showed up. Which means apathy and dissatisfaction catalyzed an ideological sea change in America.
That Texas will go to the Reagan column.
At the White House, Stu Eisenstadt watched the results with President Carter.
He has won Indiana, Virginia,
Pennsylvania.
Ohio has fallen
further. Michigan, the state of Michigan, we project.
It was like going to a funeral. I mean, seeing state after state after state come in.
Ronald Reagan will win New Jersey.
North Dakota, no surprise there.
Carter announced he would concede now. Even though most networks had not yet called the election, people were still voting in California.
He just was so humiliated, he wanted to get it over with.
In a room of supporters, Carter covered his embarrassment with his grin and an attempted humor.
The people of the United States have made their choice, and of course I accept that decision. But I have to admit, not with the same enthusiasm that I accepted the decision 4 years ago.
He kept his speech short, 6 minutes, thanked his supporters, professed his love for his country, and walked off the stage, still trying to hold that grin. It appeared this would be the enduring final image of Carter's public life, defeated, walking off.
It does seem obvious the miracle story of Jimmy Carter, the unknown Georgia governor who finally made it to the White House, is just about at an end.
Of course, a whole nother act awaited him. The farmer, the nuclear engineer, the president would become the global humanitarian, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. None of that was clear. What was clear was that the country was entering uncharted waters. Ronald Reagan, just 4 years earlier, had been derided as so fringe, so radical, and so unserious a candidate that his nomination could drive his party to extinction.
More and more analysts are predicting the Republicans will go the way of the Whigs.
But now, Reagan was president-elect of the United States, walking onto the stage for his victory party, his supporters screaming in celebration. He had won a landslide.
I am not frightened by what lies ahead, and I don't believe the American people are frightened by what lies ahead.
What lay ahead? An iconic presidency, which cemented the new Republican Party. An ideology that had been fringe became mainstream.
The Republican Party moved from being Republican first to conservative.
Carter Wren, who helped spur Reagan's comeback in North Carolina, recalls the shift.
We found that there were people that had fought us for 5 or 6 years who all of a sudden became Reagan Republicans.
The rightward turn pushed out moderate and liberal Republicans, and the battle lines between the political parties deepened.
I changed parties right after Ronald Reagan was elected.
You heard Audrey Rowe in previous episodes, a feminist black woman who'd previously supported Gerald Ford.
We lost our moral compass.
She became a Democrat, joining a party that was embracing more liberal social stances, but which also had moved to the right economically with Carter. In some ways, it resembled the old Republican Party. And what lay ahead? Across America, a new conception of what government is for, declared by leaders of both parties.
Government is the problem.
The era of big government is over.
And what lay ahead? When I think about the answer to that question, I think about tactics and rhetoric now normal in today's politics and where they came from. How charges of socialism and government takeover were once considered the purview of a conspiracy-minded fringe that was constantly predicting imminent doom.
Pretty soon, your son won't decide when he's in school where he will go or what he will do for a living. He will wait for the government to tell him.
I watched today's bruising battles over textbooks, gun laws, abortion, and other issues that viscerally divide us. I think about how and why and when they were injected into national politics.
We have to go out there and polarize the electorate.
I think a lot about distrust and how outsider candidates running against government have become the norm.
The insiders have had their chance, and they have not delivered, and their time has run out.
Since Carter, every president has either run as an outsider or been the vice president to one who has. Up and down ballots, candidates perpetually campaign against government, against Washington, no matter who's residing there. And as they have, telling us how bad government is, public trust has continued to spiral downward, which makes it even more profitable to campaign as the outsider, spreading distrust. And as I think about all of this, I spend more time than any human being reasonably should thinking about Gerald Ford. He was 87 years old when he walked slowly up to the rostrum of the U.S. Senate in 2001. Lawmakers had invited the former president to speak in his old stomping grounds, the U.S. Capitol. Ford used the opportunity to chide them.
Our parties are instruments of government much more than they are vehicles of protest.
He'd always believed in the need for the parties to compromise, and he'd grown alarmed in his late years at the fissures opening in American politics.
That it has become a blood sport.
Now he beseeched senators not to let an essential ingredient of democracy slip away.
Public faith in a system that earns our trust by appealing to what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature.
I wonder what Ford would think today as unprecedented division, emerging wedge issues, and a collapse in trust run ever more rampant. 2 decades after that speech to the Senate, a half century after his battles with Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. And I wonder what lies ahead. Landslide is a production of Nuanced Tales and is created by me, Ben Bradford. This is the end of the season, but not the series. Stay tuned to this feed for bonus episodes. If you'd like future seasons, let us know. Sign up for our mailing list at nuancedtales.com and follow us on Instagram at Landslide History. Landslide would not have been possible without our incredible production team. Rick Carr edited each script from bloated initial draft to the final product. Matt Bradford composed, performed, mixed, and mastered the music and recorded every line of my narration. Jay Siebold did the sound design and painstakingly mixed it all together into what you heard. Landslide is produced in partnership with WFAE. Greg Collard and Eli Portillo provided editorial support and strategic guidance, web design and marketing support by Jen Lang and Lena Hong. Judon Marshall is the CEO at WFAE. Other credits include the legal team at Yahtzee Butler and the agents at Workhouse Media, John McConnell, Keith Kaufman, and Paul Anderson. The podcast is distributed by the NPR Network. A big thanks to Dan McCoy, Lindsay McKenna, Kalia Ali, Gary DeWong, and the rest of the team at NPR. And finally, a special thanks to a team of early listeners who provided invaluable feedback. Maria Hollenhorst, Gerard Ritt, Jordan Nakata, Camilo and Alejandro Artiga Purcell, Allison Kranz, Haley Antonison, Kathleen Bester, Megan and Adam Batchelor, and Elizabeth Purcell and Murray Bradford. And thank you for listening.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? These are all things parents ask when they home shop. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools. Homes.com. We've done your homework. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.